This lecture is about trust in science. It's a five-part public lecture series organized jointly by the Canadian Centre for Ethics in Public Affairs at St. Mary's and the History of Science and Technology program at the University of King's College, with the generous support from the Dalhousie Department of Bioethics, the Nova Scotia Health Research Foundation, the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation is filming this, or recording this for their ideas program, Eastlink, who is filming it, and also all of our student ushers who showed you the way. In our series, we've been closely following trust around, beginning with the origins of early modern development of gentlemanly disinterested science, as it is so called. Our first speaker, Dr. Stephen Chapin from Harvard, explored the sort of moral apartheid established in the new science at the very birth of modernity in the early modern period. On the one hand, the new science was about dead matter, mathematized, controlled, and pointing towards a future of instrumental knowledge. Values were established elsewhere in the meaningful discourses of politics, aesthetics, literature, and theology. Now, this much-ballyhooed division between the two cultures has, in its late manifestation, produced parallel experts, Dr. Chapin told us, those of the expertise of natural science and then the ethics industry. With Bring, we have the example of what happens in modernity with a constant deferral of responsibility, and this was Chapin's worry. Our second speaker in the series is Dr. David Scadden, the co-director of Harvard's Stem Cell Research Institute, who opened up one side of this moral economy, the inside of the laboratory. Following controversial stem cell research, Scadden showed how scientific fact and expertise gets established on the laboratory bench. It's a messy affair, he told us, rarely coming under the gaze of those uninitiated in the day-to-day practices of the lab. It is not like your first-year textbooks that tell us something like the existence of a pure scientific method. There isn't one, Scadden noted. In the end, though, objective scientific knowledge is produced, and this is important. Dr. Scadden balked. In our question period, he was asked whether the deep involvement of particular interests, let's take cancer research, for example, or about other interests, make us worry about the trust in those facts produced by science. Dr. Scadden was perhaps rightly incensed that such a question would call into question the moral ascendancy of his colleagues and himself in scientific research. It pressed a button. Today, our speaker is going to press that button and a couple of more buttons, I bet. We've opened up a bit here the black box of scientific research and how fact and trust get established there. Today, we'll look at how those facts, expertise, and trust move from the laboratory bench to the dinner table, as our title wittily shows. And there is no one better to do this than Dr. Janice Graham. Janice Graham is a medical anthropologist and Canada Research Chair in bioethics here at Dalhousie University. She works on regulatory practices and explores scientific research and databases as culturally embedded texts. Yet she has also done postgraduate training in geriatric medicine and neuroepidemiology, funded by the Alzheimer's Society of Canada. Her work on Alzheimer's led to her to study the moral basis of a market approach to the study of disease. She comes well qualified. Her research has been awarded by, of course, the Canada Research Chair that she holds. She's held an endowed chair in medical anthropology at the University of British Columbia, in a whopping Canada Foundations for Innovation grant for launching her...
Bioethics always gets these whopping grants. So it's quite amazing.
For qualitative research commons... I do philosophy of science, you get nothing. The qualitative research commons and studio, a state-of-the-art multimedia research factory for the study of those culturally embedded databases. She crosses immediately the two cultures that are established at the very beginning of modernity and our Trust in Science series. Her border crossing and activities are enormous and envious, and she's on sabbatical, which means we had to drag her back from Europe to give this talk. I give you Dr. Janice Graham.
Thank you, Gordon, and everybody else here. Before I begin officially, I'm going to, in this talk on science, I'm going to begin with my horoscope for today. You will impress some very important people today, and you will annoy some very important people, too. So long as the people you impress are more powerful than the people you annoy, you'll have no problem at all. But if you get it the wrong way round, you might soon be looking for new employment. Get my CV ready. As I said, I'd like to thank the organizing committee. I need to begin, however, with a conflict of interest statement. I'm also a member of that organization committee. While I have considerable respect for my colleagues in this committee, I do have serious doubts about the decision to put me on the roster tonight. When Ian Stewart suggested that I give this lecture, his intention was to turn the series to issues surrounding the regulation of science and its products. And my graduate students and I have been studying issues of risk and regulation at Health Canada for a few years now. So my being here made some sense. But I also think this lecture was payback for slipping out of the country just prior to the launch of the series, and thereby avoiding the work involved in coordinating such a multimedia public event. I accepted their kind invitation to come back from my sabbatical to Nova Scotia in late January, but I have to own up that it was with some hope that the usual midwinter storms might result in canceled flights and the closure of the city. You would have had the opportunity to find your candles and reacquaint with your children, and I would be off the hook. But the chaos of climate change is, well, unpredictable, as chaos is meant to be. Thomas Aquinas noted some 800 years ago, faith has to do with things that are not seen, and hope with things that are not in hand. My hope for a January white wand was based on memories exaggerated over time, and as we know, hopes often have neither a firm foundation in facts nor an expected outcome. One can't predict uncertainty. I'm a member of a strange and exotic, or at least that's what we'd like to think, disciplinary tribe called anthropologists. My nature and by nature and method, we're a tad skeptical of hard lines between knowledge, beliefs, and practices, even our own. We study how people build explanations from the happenings around them, how they gather and manipulate facts in a convincing way, how local knowledge may be initially derided by outsiders, but later becomes the ingredients for intellectual property and biopiracy battles. The way those with power can produce and appropriate knowledge to further their own interests captures our attention, the building of the bits and pieces of empirical evidence to tell a story is our stock in trade. So instead of relying on my hope of snowstorm, I looked for the evidence that a city-stopping snowstorm would be coming up. Taking a representative sample of weather reports for late January in Nova Scotia and building in a human behavioral component, there was a strongly significant probability that though there might well be snow, it would not likely deter resolute Haligonians. So I prepared this talk. You're lucky. The discovery, construction, and translation of scientific findings in labs and clinical spaces are largely hidden from public view. In drug discovery, the image of the pipe is commonly used to describe the drug development process as a molecule becomes a medicine. The life cycle of a therapeutic product is an arduous path fraught with uncertainty and steeped in ritual. The uncertainties surrounding the risk of science are identified, assessed, turned into probabilities, and managed when its products are being translated and transformed into therapies, medicines, agricultural and food products. What do we need to demystify these ritual activities? What do we need to know in order to trust that the final products do what they claimed, what is claimed of them, safely? What structures constrain or enable that translation process, and are they worthy of your trust? Who and what are responsible for the safety, efficacy, effectiveness, and quality of these products? Tonight, we'll address some cracks in ensuring safety and efficacy in the drug discovery and development pipeline when we look closer at a particular case of a drug that made it through the safety checks in the regulatory process en route to the market and caused the deaths of thousands. We trust that the sunscreen we slather on our children and the chicken we roast and the water we drink are all safe for us, that behind the scenes, government agencies protect us from any preventable risks and dangers, for that is what they are legislated to do. The Food and Drugs Act, labor standards, the Environmental Protection Act, the list of acts and regulations to protect the public and save us from undue harm is beneath the radar for most of us. The regulatory activities of Health Canada, for example, are supposed to safeguard the health of Canadians by ensuring that new drug products are supposed to safeguard that new drug products and medical devices meet the highest standards of safety, efficacy, and quality. When they don't, we need to examine why. Some industry advocates and policymakers regard our present regulatory system as inefficient in that it delays market access for useful food and drug products, and that it thwarts research by making investment costs prohibitive. These stakeholders want fast-tracking to speed up the approval of new drugs, foods, and agricultural products, and greater harmonization of standards with international trade agreements. Others argue that regulation has already become too flexible, that the cozy relationships fostered these past years between industry and government have rendered the regulatory system ineffective. A typical scenario looks something like this. Before drugs reach the public, the industry sponsor, whom I'll refer to as pharma, must demonstrate safety and efficacy of a new drug submission to obtain government regulatory approval. They must submit the drug to an extensive scientific and clinical regulatory review process that examines all of the stages of the biologic or pharmaceutical product's life cycle. A therapeutic product's evaluation is conducted by expert government scientists and clinicians. The industry sponsor must meet with the regulators prior to the product submission to prepare them for the file and to try to negotiate a priority review of their submission based upon their product's novel nature and potential to treat serious, life-threatening, or severely debilitating diseases. A submission must contain substantive scientific evidence of the safety and quality of the product before it's approved. This may take 30 days for a clinical trial application. It may take up to 18 months for a new drug submission, although longer in exceptional cases where submissions have missing data, deficiencies, or issues that require special considerations. Since it's considered proprietary data, Health Canada has been unwilling to report the number of submissions it receives that do not get approved, but it's known to be a very, very small portion. A few years ago, a renewal process swept Health Canada and other government regulatory groups. A commitment to a smart regulation strategy followed in the 2003 throne speech to ensure faster access to safer drugs for Canadians. In response, Health Canada initiated the therapeutic access strategy and announced a new objective to operate as a timely, transparent, innovative, and sustainable regulator. The 2003 strategy for improving the regulatory process prioritized innovation and provided a framework where risk can be managed and voluntary standards are adopted. In smart regulation, quote, business or commercial or non-commercial third parties exerting controlling interests should become surrogate or quasi-regulators, complementing or replacing government regulation in certain circumstances. Most of us know little about what actually happens as science is translated to products of public utility. We remain pleasantly ignorant, comforted that good government protects our public health. Others adopt a more informed, skeptical position, given the level of ambiguous information and situational science that surrounds us. The intervention of ideology and politics into reconfiguring scientific interpretation was captured a couple of weeks ago by Gary Trudeau in the comic strip Doonesbury. A lot of people feel a bit like Stewie when he says, "I'll never trust science again." But is it science itself, or is it its brokers and an inadequate regulatory mechanism that need attention? We're all aware of the political nature of fact production to some extent. The scientific, medical, and popular media have teemed these past years with accounts of conflict, of interest, tainted blood, contaminated drinking water, mad cows, and neurodegenerating hamburgers, and lately, cloned cows on our dinner plate. It leaves us wondering how facts get selected, funded, constructed, and sometimes distorted. Indeed, a few of us might even wonder whether empirical evidence is necessary at all to sway political decision-making. The lack of evidence for weapons of mass destruction didn't divert the U.S. invasion of Iraq. Underlying any evidence of scientific fact, that the following questions lurk. Where do the facts come from? How reliable and accurate are they? Who says so? Whose interests do they serve, and who pays for or profits from them? But I don't think it's individuals we should be hunting down, wayward, corrupt anti-heroes lacking moral values and driven by self-interest. Sure, these types exist, but not in a monolithic black and white Darth Vader way. Instead, as I said at the outset, we should turn our attention to structural cracks along the pipe that allow less than safe and effective science to slip through and enter the public sphere. That science is a cultural activity and that specific data are put together from constellations of possible molecules in ways that are enabled or constrained by the instruments and the technical and theoretical skills of those making the observations is not news. But what is news since the Second World War is the way in which objectivity is performed in bioscience, including biomedicine, and this has some major implications for their practices. The entities and protocols of biomedicine have become the product of an unprecedented level of coordination and convention carried out by complex bioclinical networks and consortia. Alberto Cambrosio and colleagues call this regulatory objectivity, marked by the rise of large and powerful networks of scientists and clinicians collectively producing evidence through the systematic standardization of the same entities and protocols under production. Agreed-upon conventions allow not single but multiple collaborating labs to perform precisely the same procedures using the same instruments. Consensus groups made up of experts create clinical guidelines and identify diagnostic subtypes based upon large-scale aggregated population data. The statistics and conventions organize the data and protocols in a way that produce and give meaning to new biomedical entities. As Cambrosio and colleagues see it, the regulations create the entities they regulate. As opposed to the traditional lab science, in regulatory science, biomedicine has replaced true values with established conventions. The work of harmonizing global standards takes place using aggregated data derived from these multi-sided clinical trials, presented at these international peer meetings and agreed upon by the peers, usually well known to one another, at invited and closed consensus conferences. Now, make no mistake of the power of authoritative knowledge that gets published as guidelines and recommendations to influence clinical practices from these gatherings of experts. What remains less certain is the impartial or independent nature of the contributor's science. But we trust that in good time, the processes that lead to a common recognition of a particular pattern, a constellation of scientific and clinical facts, will hit on the correct answer, the truth. Certainly, the science of climate change has taken some convincing before action seems nigh. Reports are now in from hundreds of scientists whose work has contributed to the UN's Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. There now appears to be acknowledgement of the enormous environmental, political, social, and health consequences of droughts in sub-Saharan Africa, the melting of polar ice, record-breaking temperatures, and unusual climatic events across the planet, and some common cause as well. Few who have gathered in this room would contest the overwhelming scientific evidence for climate change. No one can argue that the 10 warmest years on record have been in the last 12, and that this likely is a spin-off of our own activities on this planet. And yet, denials exist. Furthermore, they tend to get published where it counts for public impact. Just 2 months ago, for example, and timed to coincide with the release of the Stern Report on Climate Change in the UK, which concluded, by the way, that delaying policies to respond to climate change will cost governments significantly more, the Sunday Telegraph published a 52-page article over two consecutive weeks that declared climate change a left-wing conspiracy hoax coordinated by the United Nations. With graphs and tables and references, Viscount Monckton of Brenchley, who holds a degree in classical studies, contested the credibility of climate change in a newspaper that is read by hundreds of thousands, many of whom, we can be sure, do not regularly read journals like Nature or Science. While we might dismiss Lord Monckton's account, it isn't really science after all. We should think back to the success of the tobacco lobby's campaign to obfuscate scientific evidence linking cancer and smoking with facts of their own. This is situational science in living color. We recognize that there are some problems in public understanding and the dissemination of credible science, but how do we understand disagreements among the experts themselves, or their tendency to enroll those who agree with them but exclude those who don't from review committees and expert panels? After some two generations of clinicians recommending long-term use of estrogen and progesterone hormone replacement therapy, the results of the Women's Initiative randomized controlled trial of HRT released its findings in 2004. They concluded that women on the drug long-term were at increased risk of cancer and possibly increased risk of cardiovascular disease. The overwhelming lesson from the findings of the Women's Initiative, according to Nancy Krager and colleagues, is the necessity of framing contemporary scientific research and policy in historical, social, economic, and political context, so as to illuminate the oft-concealed technical, administrative, economic, and political decisions and values that shape scientific inquiry and its impact on population health. What are the mechanisms and platforms to safeguard that unbiased research results get untranslated to clinicians and to their patients? Or for that matter, as my postdoctoral fellow Mavis Jones is working on, how do we get the expert knowledge of the patients and public translated up to regulators in science? For it's in the translation of research, what Janet Atkinson-Grosjean calls the ampersand in the R&D of research and development, that the trouble seems to lurk. And yet we rely on trust. We trust those most likely to profit from a new drug to tell us how good it is. That? And we trust that the newspapers who are dependent on pharma funding will be objective when telling us about pharma's latest breakthrough, like Double Dot. It's not in their interest to present anything but a positive swing in the story to build your hopes. Hope sells newspapers and advertising and desire for the new technological trinkets coming down the pipe, even before they're proven. UBC epidemiologist Barbara Mintzes has produced a substantial body of research that shows the capacity of pharma's direct-to-consumer marketing to scam physicians into prescribing and the public into buying expensive new drugs with less effectiveness, higher costs, and compromised safety. Here at Dalhousie, Sharon Batt is studying the negotiations and consequences around potential conflicts of interest as patient advocacy groups have become dependent on pharma funding. Effective techniques to govern industry funding of science and advocacy deserve our attention, but principled words alone are insufficient. A group of concerned scientists have charged that between 1998 and 2005, ExxonMobil spent nearly $16 million to fund a network of 43 advocacy organizations that seek to confuse the public on global warming science. And despite being found guilty for defrauding the state of Alabama of oil royalties and slapped with a $12 billion penalty, ExxonMobil's website sports, oddly enough, a business ethics and standards page. It's pro forma that universities and companies declare their ethics, but it's in practices and actions where ethical standards are performed that counts. Researchers David Healy and Nancy Olivieri and experienced demotions, rescinding of job offers, and slander from institutions intent on not promising their industry sponsors, not compromising their industry sponsorships. What structural actions could contribute to our regaining trust in interpretations of scientific facts? More effective incentives would be the response of the liberal persuader, and tighter checks and balances, that's the post-thalidomide command and control, but pre-smart regulator talking. Certainly, strategies that build in precautionary approaches to new technologies adoption when the evidence isn't all in make sense, and so do providing tools to be read, to be better read, to be better able to interpret and challenge the evidence before it becomes practice. We want techniques to judge which evidence is better, stronger, more reliable, and accurate. But these tools already exist in evidence-based medicine, and they replace authority. They replace authority. Evidence-based medicine replaces authority with evidence from randomized controlled trials, systematic reviews, and meta-analyses of the best studies. So what's the problem? Why doesn't everyone use evidence-based medicine to interpret the quality, the trustworthiness of clinical research? Well, evidence-based decisions require data from well-designed randomized controlled trials carried out in large populations. Now, reliance on population statistics over individualized measures and meaning always raises the eyebrows of anthropologists. We're advocates of the quality over quantity camp, after all. And we're building ways to address these concerns. But mostly, concern about RCTs lies with the fact that they cost a lot of money to design and conduct these large clinical trials. And mostly this money comes from pharma, whose monopoly of clinical research studies and of the clinical researchers who conduct their trials seriously reduces the opportunities for non-pharma studies. When pharma clinical trials are published, the same trial gets reported by multiple authors in multiple journals. These seed the clinical community. They let docs know that something new with what looks like positive results is in the pipe. But health technology assessment teams, whether they're government regulatory reviewers or national and provincial agencies set up to assess new technologies, often find holes in these data. Tasked with independently assessing the quality, the soundness, and the trustworthiness of these trials, they draw upon the best scientific evidence, okay, for the clinical efficacy and cost effectiveness and broader impact of new medicines and technologies. What's surprising is how minimal that evidence may be. Systematic reviews reveal the number of clinical trials that add no added value. Beginning with a thorough literature search, health technology assessors toss out those studies that suffer design and analysis flaws or are repeats of one another. A recent tech assessment by the Canadian Agency for Drugs and Technologies in Health shows this, and I quote, from 1,004 identified citations, 198 were potentially relevant. Of these, 69 citations met inclusion criteria for a total of 25 unique trials. And this for a drug that has been on our market for 8 years and prescribed to millions of people with limited substantive new data or longitudinal results after 8 years on the market. Evidence-based medicine has provided us with the tools we need to examine clinical trials for trustworthiness, critical appraisal, systematic review, and these meta-analyses of the translational clinical trials research. But sound health technology assessment depends on full access to all of the data, details of how that data are collected, unsuccessful as well as successful trials, and full disclosure of the interests of the contributing researchers. The assessors should be independent of pharma, which some would claim is like finding a needle in the haystack. Now, many pharma-funded clinical researchers are outraged by their credibility, their honesty being called into question. They know that they can put aside their funding interests when it comes to judging science. They challenge independent health technology assessors for their lack of clinical experience with the drugs if their analyses find the drug is less effective or less efficacious than the positions held by these clinical experts. And these self-regulating consensus panels of experts, whose meetings are often at least partially funded by pharma, go on to publish practice guidelines, ignoring the concerns of the evidence-based epidemiologists and statisticians. The saying, think for yourself and question authority, is attributed to Timothy Leary, whose notoriety for using hallucinogenic drugs has been overwritten by the CIA and Canadian government-backed Cold War experiments that use the drugs on non-consensual research psychiatric patients. By drawing attention to the uneven power relationships in the collection, distribution, and dissemination of authoritative knowledge, it does some work for the discussion of trust in science. As Cambrosio and colleagues pointed out, regulatory objectivity involves collaborations in research networks and shared tools and standards, and is now essential for moving science along. But the science that gets moved along may not fully represent the work of many scientists. Not all scientists are heard equally. Christina Holmes is a doctoral researcher here at Dell, almost finished. And she shows that GMO scientists work on many different types of plant engineering projects, the diversity of which get lost in activist discourse. For the scientists, research focused on plants that add vitamins to poor subsistence farmers' crops is fundamentally different from profit-based research that creates plants that are resistant to herbicides. Not only do these projects have slightly different scientific pathways, they have different moral, environmental, and health implications. Regulators understand these differences and therefore evaluate the risks in novel GM foods on a case-by-case basis. But by the time the GM products reach the grocery store, all GMs have been painted with one brush and with the same risk potential. Why the disconnect? Well, it turns out that so far the GM products that do get commercial licenses are either GMOs that produce their own pesticides or GMOs resistant to herbicide application. As the property of large multinational companies, these GMOs have been judged by activists to be bad for the environment, bad for the health, and not to be trustworthy. Scientists, on the other hand, would like to see the full range of GM plants on which they work in the fields, But for the most part, the GM products that promise hopes of food security in the less developed regions are of little interest to venture capitalists. Apart from publicly funded projects, they simply don't get translated because they lack the funds to get through regulatory clearance. Meanwhile, back at the supper table, consumers are making decisions about the involvement of scientific technologies in their food, which is now based upon the knowledge that they are produced by an increasingly consolidated food industry at increasing distance from their kitchens. Consumers and activists see GM foods as corporate experiments to control global food production, where the public are the guinea pigs. Meanwhile, the less profit-oriented science languishes back in the small lab waiting for funding for its big break. UBC's Janet Atkinson-Grosjean describes this new style of scientific collaborations in her book Public Science, Private Interests, which examines Canada's networks of centres of excellence. She documents how Canada, along with other governments, has directed science policy since the early 1980s to embrace neoliberal ideals of fiscal restraint, tax minimization, deregulation, and marketization. Market principles of cost recovery, competitiveness, and entrepreneurship in the provision of public services took root in strategic science policies, and the rhetoric of innovation gained a firm foothold. This made way for a professional administration to assist scientists in adopting the new managerial requirements, and it moved what had been considered open science for the public good into proprietary knowledge where ideas and materials become potentially profitable intellectual property that require protection. Knowledge translation, that is, the moving of research into products, practice, and policy, requires partnerships with industry and contributes public resources that assist the transfer of intellectual property to these private partnerships. In essence, as Atkinson-Grosjean points out, strategic science oversees the transfer of publicly supported university-based bench science using university-industry liaison services that now exist on our campuses to prepare the intellectual property transfer of the more successful and profitable discoveries for the private sector. Atkinson-Grosjean asks, why public networks are being funded to generate private goods? Jonas Salk responded with a question of his own when asked why he hadn't patented the polio vaccine in 1954. Salk asked, how can you patent the sun? That response seems now, well, sadly naive, or does it? Atkinson-Grosjean points out that while Canada's centers of excellence have served an important role in raising the scientific capital of translational science and transformed it from being a poor theoretical cousin of basic science by what insiders suggest has been a $2.25 billion injection, those scientists have had to work through an uncomfortable, ideologically marked closed science model which counters the open and cooperative ethos of scientific integrity. And the requirement of these elite centers of excellence be controlled by selected research leaders charged with finding profitable approaches to disease has replaced the flat collegial arrangements most academic researchers prefer with a managing elite operating within hierarchical corporate free market frameworks. That this concentration on funding established a cadre of exceptionally powerful scientific power brokers has been argued to be detrimental to scientific diversity and capacity building, closing off potential new fields of inquiry. Indeed, this model that favors a chosen academic research elite has the ominous specter of eugenics. As any student of actor network theory would note, the scientists who rise to elite positions are not typically delegated to these positions, but rather they tend to be exceptionally successful at enrolling and aligning the interests of potential allies towards their own and intervening to consolidate power and agency. But while some entrepreneurs, whom Atkinson-Grosjean has dubbed merchant scientists, have prospered in this climate, there are still a firm majority, some 80% of scientists within these networks, have chosen to identify with and stay within an open academic science model where the exchange of scientific discoveries are not restricted by disclosure restrictions and commercial restraints. But whether the next generation grows accustomed to commercial science is uncertain. We can follow the open source zines on the internet using our gateway computers to find out. So it seems misguided to place the responsibility for accountable and trustworthy science as it operates now in large consortiums and networks on the shoulders of individuals whose skills have been honed for individual achievement and power. Rather than put ourselves at the mercy of the moral practices of individual heroes, we instead have legislation and laws and regulations to protect us. Hockey games need referees, drivers need traffic signs, bakers need recipes. Arbitrary rules and regulations don't work. They work better when all the actors involved can agree to the rules, or at least to abide by the rules. Merck's withdrawal of Rofecoxib, Vioxx, in 2004, after it was found to double the risk of heart attacks in patients taking it for longer than 18 months, was the tip of an iceberg that toppled the already shaky foundation that the U.S. Food and Drugs Administration, and indeed Health Canada, had major problems in how risks and benefits get balanced for drug approval. It raised an alarm of a flawed record of regulation and monitoring of drug safety by the FDA and Health Canada. Studies done 5 years prior to the withdrawal of Vioxx suggested that the same mechanism that inhibits inflammation and makes the drugs easier on the stomach than traditional painkillers also blocks a substance that prevents heart problems. The COX-2 story is one where there was ample evidence to suggest safety issues, but where the manufacturer, Merck, obscured these data, preventing accurate harm-benefit analysis. A Canadian health technology assessment team had a significant role in getting these data revealed. The UBC-based therapeutics initiatives asked for but were refused data they needed to evaluate the clinical trials of Pfizer's celecoxib, the very first COX-2 selective inhibitor to be licensed. While the less toxic celecoxib has remained on the market subject to safety warnings, it took 4 years before two of the more harmful COX-2s, Vioxx and Bextra, were withdrawn. How could this happen? The COX-2 selective NSAIDs, non-steroidal anti-inflammatories, were launched with a sophisticated marketing campaign in Canada in 1999. Pfizer licensed and marketed this new class of drugs on the basis of a hypothesis that the COX-2s offered arthritis sufferers fewer gastrointestinal adverse effects and less GI toxicity than the previous class of non-selective NSAIDs, that's things like ibuprofen and naproxen. And they did this without any published evidence for their claims. There were no published evidence in it, when these drugs were licensed for either efficacy or safety. New drugs can be licensed without head-to-head clinical trials comparing them with existing drugs, but not without showing that the drugs compare favorably to placebo. Evidence of safety and efficacy, that is, that the drugs perform better than nothing at all, is required before a therapeutic product is licensed in Canada. Those are the rules. The Therapeutics Initiative Group speculated that Health Canada's therapeutic products program must have had access to unpublished data. But without any data publicly available, independent review was impossible. They pointed out that without publication of trial reports, an essential feature of the scientific method is lost. Full disclosure of experimental methods and analysis is needed so that the research can be replicated, critically appraised, and accepted or refuted. Meanwhile, Merck was pushing through approval of their COX-2 Vioxx. After Pfizer and Merck both published their clinical trials in 2000, a year after these drugs were on the market, the sale of their COX-2 inhibitors, Celebrex and Vioxx, soared. Still, the Therapeutics Initiative Group remained concerned that the journal articles failed to tell the whole story, reporting, for example, that only short-term, six-month trial data, despite having data that extended up to 15 months. Systematic reviews of the various clinical trials of NSAIDs were unable to conclude the magnitude of benefits of NSAIDs due to incomplete reporting, biased analysis, and presentation of the trial results. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration released online more complete trial data in 2000 and performed their own review of the data, which had had a very different conclusion. The FDA's conclusion was different than the published trial data and the data that they accepted these drugs in the first place on. The FDA panel found that there was no safety benefit for Celebrex, yet this didn't stop Pfizer's Celecoxib from making $3.1 billion worldwide in 2001. While patients taking Vioxx had less complicated and symptomatic ulcers, they had more myocardial infarctions than patients on naproxen. Although the COX-2s were marketed successfully as novel agents that reduced symptomatic gastrointestinal ulcers, that alone was insufficient to prove that they were better than non-selective NSAIDs. And most people saw that. The health technology assessors all saw this. Thus, the monographs of celecoxib, rofecoxib, meloxicam, include the same warning of risk of GI toxicity as is given for all the other NSAIDs. No one, not even the manufacturers, could claim that the COX-2s were more beneficial than the already available non-selective NSAIDs. And the manufacturer's own data showed the increased myocardial infarctions years before they withdrew them from the market. Three notable issues affected the absolute number of people who suffered serious adverse events related to the COX-2s. One is the sophisticated advertising campaign of Merck and Pfizer that guaranteed that many more people would be prescribed a COX-2 selective NSAID than the clinical trials could have sufficiently represented for wider harm-benefit analysis. The second is that published studies of the Pfizer and Merck clinical trials provided an incomplete picture of the overall benefit and harm of the celecoxib and rofecoxibs, and counter to the symptomatic claims made in marketing the COX-2 selective NSAIDs, they actually showed no difference in gastrointestinal-related deaths compared to non-selected NSAIDs. This issue relates to how randomized controlled trials, for the most part, are designed by industry to show efficacy, that is, that a drug works in a very tightly controlled clinical trial select population. But once a drug is licensed, physicians can prescribe it to whomever they deem might respond favorably. Then its effectiveness in the real world plays out. Efficacy has high internal validity at the expense of generalizability. When these drugs are then prescribed and indeed marketed to a much larger population who are older and less healthy, then you have a situation ripe for an explosion of adverse safety events. Absolute benefits and risks based on clinical efficacy change when drugs are released to a wider market. A drug that produces adverse events in clinical trials can be pretty certain to cause considerably greater harm when it becomes available for larger populations. That much more if it becomes a blockbuster. And the third notable issue is that the cozy relationship between industry and regulators produced a situation where inadequate vigilance was paid to the data, and in particular the missing data that the company concealed. That independent health technology assessors questioned the physiological hypothesis of COX-2's selective mechanisms and why data weren't available, while our regulators did not question these things, should concern us all. And that once these data were revealed and reports of cardiovascular deaths were coming in as early as 2000, why did our regulators wait until Merck itself agreed to voluntarily withdraw Vioxx in 2004? A 2004 memorandum from the FDA's Associate Director of Science says, and I'll just cut it this short, high-dose rofecoxib conferred a 3.7-fold increase in risk and standard dose, and the standard dose a 1.5-fold increase compared with celecoxib, the most frequently prescribed COX-2 selective agent. We estimate that the increased rofecoxib risk observed in this study would yield in excess of 27,785 cases of acute myocardial infarction and sudden cardiac death in the U.S. over the years 1999 and 2003. In 2004, the International Committee of Medical Journal Editors announced a requirement for the registration of all clinical trials before they would agree to publish trial results. It's worth repeating their own paragraph. Altruism and trust lie at the heart of research on human subjects. Altruistic individuals volunteer for research because they trust that their participation will contribute to improved health for others and that researchers will minimize risks to participants. In return for the altruism and trust that make clinical research possible, the research enterprise has an obligation to conduct research ethically and to report it honestly. The medical journal editors established a platform for the open and transparent sharing of clinical trial results, by which an honest reporting begins with revealing the existence of all clinical studies, even those that reflect unfavorably on a research sponsor's product. www.clinicaltrials.gov gives you access to all of those publicly registered trials now, publicly registered. What happens to the private trials that never get registered? Well, they won't get published, and scientists won't get to share what didn't work unless they belong to the right circles. What have we learned and what do we trust? It remains the responsibility of the community of science and industry who sponsor the clinical trials to submit all relevant data and results for review by government regulators, health technology evaluators. We need to regain confidence that the data are reliable, accurate, and available for analysis by independent, unbiased researchers who have no stake, whether with regard to receiving industry-partnered grants or, more difficult, in wanting to provide their desperate patients with some marginal hope. We need to trust the quality of the data, and these must be made available for access and impartial analysis. It took thousands of deaths that pointed to concealed data and corporate criminal negligence to create the international and professional furor necessary to push something as basic as a publicly available registration system through. Similar attempts prior to the Merck debacle produced only noncommittal responses from industry that registries might threaten intellectual property. We rely on the thoroughness of the evaluators at the FDA, Health Canada, and other national agencies responsible for drug safety to conduct careful evaluations of therapeutic and food products. And we know that companies are legally bound to provide all relevant data in their drug submissions. But what happens when they don't? And what happens when, as some have suggested, the health protection role that our regulatory agencies used to highlight gets eroded to risk management by an ideology converted to policy that favors freedom of market forces and consumer choice? Well, in the case of Merck, and only after thousands of deaths, their markets share dropped. And maybe, after all, it's to the marketplace we must turn for consequences. The President's address, the CIHR President's address to researchers in the Canadian Institutes of Health Research community was sobering this month. Despite increased funding since the dark days of the 90s when fiscal restraints tied the hands of publicly funded science, CIHR has less uncommitted funds to award new grant applications this year. But as we can see here, and please understand that by no means am I advocating cutting the big guy on the, those that big basic research sort of package on the left. Maybe after all, I'm not actually. The public funding of translational research, which are these three other categories, clinical, health systems, and population health, they all do a real work of translation. As you can see, they're kind of small beans, aren't they? Because our government actually relies on that as being the private. That's the translation work that industry is supposed to kick in, and the government expects that. If the commercial sector won't fund it, then it just doesn't get funded, and we see that with Christina Holmes' work with GMO scientists. There are those that argue that the rhetoric of innovation hides a pharmaceutical industry that is nothing really new down the pipe. They declare that the party's over, that the era of profit-soaring blockbuster drugs is dead because industry got greedy, stopped investing in truly innovative science, that corporate managers have failed to understand science, they didn't recognize the complex, lengthy, and unpredictable nature of the drug R&D, and it's hard to argue with those facts. Joel Lechtchin has shown that getting drugs to the market faster is neither effective nor efficient when those same drugs later have to be withdrawn because of their harmful side effects. In Canada, between 1963 and 2004, 41 approved products were withdrawn from the Canadian market for safety reasons. The rate increased since 1993. 16 of the 41 were withdrawn since 1993. And with respect to innovation, of 1,147 newly patented drugs reviewed between 1990 and 2003, only 5.9% were breakthrough drugs. But between 2000 and 2004, only 3.4% were breakthrough drugs. That's not really innovation. There's little doubt that the remarkable marketing directed at physicians by pharma has contributed to less worthy drugs getting prescribed, and the medical community must take some responsibility for adopting these breakthrough drugs on the company's promotional material. Add in a self-regulated professional hubris where the decisions of authoritative experts can ignore measured scientific data and appear as practice guidelines anyway, and we have the situation where distrust in both process and outcome simmers. Add in research subjects and patient deaths and it boils over. Scientific authority both derives and emanates from conventions and collaborations. As these collaborations necessarily involve private funding sources in order to get the product through the pipe, conflicts of interest and more tacit conflicts masquerading behind professional organizations and expertise have arisen. When the only evidence available has to turn a buck in order to be produced, we need to build new strategies to ensure that research that may initially have no known end product can still get funded. It's structural elements that provide an environment where, within which disingenuous practices can prevail that we need to consider, rather than blame the moral makeup of individuals. The vast majority of science and medicine is conducted by social, morally engaged individual researchers and practitioners attempting to do good, and most of them would also like to do well. It's the balance of doing good and doing well, professionally and privately, that we might want to take a closer look. In the report on the governance structure of the Canadian Medical Association Journal, after the controversial firing of its two senior editors, an independent panel expressed concerns that while they had no objection to a medical journal being profitable, they were concerned that profitability might be identified or inferred as the primary driver for such a journal. They concluded that there must be a high level of trust and good faith involved on both sides of the editorial and publishing function. No governance structure can legislate, impose, or guarantee either characteristics. In the final analysis, the structures of governance become particularly important when there has been an erosion of trust and good faith. The CMAJ governance panel established a series of recommendations before credibility could return to the journal. Whether it has remains for us to see. So too are government regulatory agencies and industry itself, and indeed the professional groups that deliver health and food products to us, will need to be seen to establish a clearer set of procedures, at once more transparent and accountable to the public, and with tighter mechanisms and controls that establish the quality, safety, efficacy, and monitor carefully the effectiveness of products translated to the public. Thank you.